And welcome everyone to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Emma Oldwinkle is my guest this week. Emma is based in Leicester. We find out about the notion of pilgrimage journeys, indeed doing a PhD as a pilgrimage journey. Emma used to live in Canterbury, where I am based, and she talks about how the journey has come full circle for her. We find out about her diary of a disabled PhD student. She talks about her chronic illness, how it impacts on her ability to get to places, and about how technology has opened up a whole new world for disabled people. We learn how the return to physical meetings and classes has posed a problem for Emma, and we talk about how technology will evolve post-COVID. We reflect upon the days of queuing up to use the telephone and renting televisions, and Emma shares a wonderful anecdote about hiding from the TV rental man. We learn about Emma's PhD and how she has done something really innovative, and we find out about how the creative writing aspect appeals and what this all teaches us about social issues. Emma talks about how there are many people in the media with hidden disabilities, why last year was the year of death. Emma reflects on how the twists and turns we experience in life make us who we are as people, what she always dreamed of doing from a young age, and Emma talks about how bad experiences can be put to good use and the importance of exploring. It was a huge privilege to catch up with Emma for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it's a great pleasure to meet, for the very first time, Emma Oldwinkle for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Great to meet you, Emma, and you're up in Leicester.
Yes, that's right, Leicester, right in the middle of England.
And am I right in thinking that you have a Canterbury connection as well?
Yes, that is, yes. Another coincidence, what I've been reflecting on lately. I moved to Canterbury when I was 18, and it was by accident, really. And that's another thing what I've been reflecting on, that I've somehow done a number of pilgrimage journeys, even living in Canterbury, which is a city of pilgrimage, and sort of the connection with pilgrimage and doing a PhD, almost like a PhD is a pilgrimage, you know, like a difficult journey, but kind of like an awakening of some sort. I'm still waiting for that to happen, but yeah, I lived in Canterbury when I was 18, and then I moved to Ashford, and then I moved back to Leicester. I had some great times in Canterbury, absolutely fantastic. I call Canterbury my university years, and I wasn't at university at the time, no association with University of Kent at the time, but ironically I'm here talking to you, the head of theology at University of Kent. And yeah, what was interesting is I worked at Canterbury Youth Hostel on New Dover Road, and we have worked split shifts. So quite often I'd go into town, into the city centre, and on the main strip of the city centre, at the end, you've got like an archway, old medieval archway. And if you go through that, in the distance is the university, isn't it? All right, but I never went through the arch. I always stayed on the other side of the arch, and I just find it a series of coincidences. Like last year, one of my unfortunately she's not my supervisor anymore, she went on long term sick, but my main supervisor at the time, I found out she done her PhD at University of Kent, and she lived in Canterbury, and her partner still has Canterbury connections. And I was thinking, oh yeah, at the time you was on the other side of the arch, I was on the other side, we never met all them years, and now we meet in a strange kind of way.
And I've encountered so many of these, particularly even with the place I went to university in West Wales, where sometimes despite it being a very small university, where you'd often see the same people 6-7 times a day. You didn't need mobile phones in those days. In fact, they didn't exist in those days, or certainly not in Lampeter anyway. You'd never get a reception in the early 90s. And then suddenly, like 30 years on, you discover that you've got all these things in common with people who went to the same university as you. But it's like taken 30 years for you to get to know them. And it makes you go back over that whole period of your life, because you suddenly realise that you've got shared memories with somebody, but they're not memories that you had together, but you were at the same event. So you've got two separate versions, two separate biographies, if you like, of being in the same place at the same time, but not knowing you're in the same place at the same time until several decades later. So somebody should write a novel about all of this.
Yeah. It would definitely be interesting. And here I am as well talking to you, and you, of course, in Canterbury. So, but very, very fond memories of Canterbury.
And where's home for you originally, Emma?
Yeah, grew up in Leicester, moved to Canterbury when I was 18, moved to Ashford down the road from Canterbury, and then I moved back to Leicester.
So that's a nice, that's quite a nice journey, actually. So actually, you're back now at the place where the journey began for you.
Yes. It's almost like full circle. Yeah. And I met with a professor a few weeks ago, and she sort of was asking me about my PhD, and I said to her, I said, oh, it's called the Diary of a Disabled PhD Student. And she said, isn't that almost like going full circle? Like, how can you write about the experience as you're in it, kind of thing? And I was like, yes, it is going full circle. Coincidentally, I went to a talk last year by Essua Jane Goldsmith, and she's done a memoir recently, but she came to Leicester because she did study at the University of Leicester in the 70s, and she was the first black woman to be the president of the student union. So she was doing a talk about that, and she's doing a talk about a memoir, and she said it's almost like I've gone full circle in a way. And I think there was something about that, but I think the circle sort of keeps on going round like a hamster wheel sometimes, you know.
Yeah, and the good thing is that sometimes you sort of come off the circle, or the circle becomes a slightly different sort of shape, it morphs into something else, but then somehow you return, and it's sort of that combination of being linear and cyclical. Sometimes you sort of the two sort of different trajectories sort of go parallel, and then of course you've got these associations with place, but often those places may look very different, or the people that you associate with them are now older, and in some cases people have passed on. So you've got sort of very clear memories, but from a different age, when we all look different, and some of the, like, for example, now here we are, there's a Canterbury connection for both of us. I'm in Canterbury at the moment, and obviously you spent some years here, but in those days Zoom didn't exist, or Teams didn't exist, so we wouldn't have been able to sort of meet in this kind of way. So it's like using the way that the technology also has a bearing on our understanding of place and space.
Oh, absolutely. And when you, because I've developed a chronic illness, which has caused some complications, shall we say, in the last few years. So when I go out and about, I predominantly use crutches and a wheelchair. And also I've got one condition called ulcerative colitis, which means I need to know where the toilet is at all times. That is the most anxiety-provoking thing about my journeys to places. People sometimes think it's the wheelchair issue, but no, it's a toilet issue. And so my sense of getting to places is much different than it was, say, during my time living in Canterbury. Because we was setting up the today, weren't we? And I was actually thinking about coming to Canterbury lately anyway, because I last came to Canterbury 10 years ago, and the time before that I was actually living in Canterbury 10 years before that. So I thought, oh, it'd be kind of a nice anniversary type thing to come 10 years down the line in 2022. But then I actually sat back and realized actually the difficulties of that now compared to 10 years ago. Now, coincidentally, 10 years ago, when I did come visit to Canterbury, I was doing a work trip at the time in Kent. So I thought, oh, I'll stop off at, at Canterbury. And at the time, I was going through an eating disorder. And it was just like literally a couple of months before I went in hospital treatment for the eating disorder, inpatient treatment. So I've got a picture of me outside the old base. And at the time, I didn't like photos of myself very often, but there's this rare photo of me in my anorexic stage. And now, obviously, I look back and I think, who is that person? Because I look completely different than when my time living in Canterbury, physically. But then 10 years down the line, if I was to go back there and take the same photo, I'd look different completely again because I'd have the wheelchair crutches and all that kind of stuff. And then I was thinking, right, if I go to Canterbury now, how do I get there, right? So I'm thinking in my head, right, I've got three wheelchairs at the minute, right? And you might think, well, why does someone have three wheelchairs, right? Well, I started off with the self-propelled one, well, which I thought was a self-propelled wheelchair, right? But in reality, you need someone to push you. When you see these people on the Paralympics and they're pushing themselves really fast, and you think, oh yeah, I'll get one of them when I became disabled. So I thought, oh, it'd be so easy to push myself on this wheelchair. And it's not at all. There's a whole different makes of self-propelled wheelchairs, and the lighter weight one you can get is the better. But obviously, I didn't know that at the time. So I got this cheaper one, and it didn't really. And I wanted my independence more and stuff like that. And I didn't realize the whole wheelchair system at the time, right? Because obviously, new to it. And there's a wheelchair service in Leicester run by the NHS, commissioned by the NHS. Now, to access that service, there needs to be a referral from the GP. So my GP, who's absolutely lovely, done the referral. And then you have to go through this whole assessment and paperwork. I didn't realise there was an eligibility criteria for the NHS. But anyway, we've done this assessment, and they said, yes, you tick the box for an electric wheelchair. I thought, great, I've got my independence now, right? But need. I mean, it's great, don't get me wrong, it's fantastic that they gave me this wheelchair, right? But it's quite heavy, right? To get it in the car, you need a hoist, right? Now, this is the added complication here, right? Because I do drive, and that surprises a lot of people actually that I do drive. Anyway, we've got some problems getting the car situation sorted. Now, my parents' car doesn't have a hoist in it, right? Now, to get a hoist fitted, an average hoist costs £3,000, right? And even more money to an existing car. So, anyway, we're trying to figure all of this out, how we actually get this NHS electric wheelchair car in the car. Anyway, I went to this great event called NADEX. It's in NEC Birmingham, a disability event. Absolutely fantastic. And you get like it's like shopping for a car when you shop for a wheelchair. There's all these different makes, models. Anyway, but I found out by random afterwards, this lightweight electric wheelchair, which supposed to pick up and fit in the chair, fit in the car, you see. So thought, great, let's get this, right? And it has been a godsend. Excuse my pun using God's name there, but it has been absolutely brilliant, right? Because it's fitted in my mum or dad's car, so that's one tick box done. But because it's a small electric wheelchair, it's got small wheels on it. So it's great in hospitals or shopping malls or anything like that. But if you go down any normal paths, with a bit of potholes or a bit of uneven surfaces, that is it, you toppled over. So I was thinking, How would I get to Canterbury? Well, I thought I could get the train instead of using the small wheelchair in my parents' car because I don't want to have the risk of it going down the pothole. So I can use my NHS chair, go on the train, but then I have to book the train in advance when you're disabled because you have to, you can't just get in and out. And there's a great story of this journalist who ended up being stuck on a train for hundreds of miles because there wasn't any service getting him off the train the other end. So I started panicking about that. I thought, what about that? I'd have to book a hotel room. Now there's Cherilee Houston, who's in Coronation Street, who plays Izzy. She's a great disability advocate. She's done a great publicity about accessible hotel accommodation and actually how inaccessible it is. And there's this great guy from Leicester, actually, Samuel. Oh, I can't remember his name off the top of my head now. But anyway, he's a great artist and he's done this remake of this hotel room. And it's making a non-disabled person feel in the shoes of a disabled person. So it's sort of flips on its head. And then I thought, oh, and then I've got to be around people and I'm in the category of immune suppressed group and whilst lockdown period that I mean that was a great anxiety of people in the immune suppressed group of catching stuff. And that is still a thing with a lot of people. I still have anxiety about mixing with a lot of people and all the germs and stuff like that. And then I thought, well, after all that, I thought, well, it is December, it is cold as well. I thought maybe I'll hold off doing the Canterbury trip this year. Maybe that's something for next year. And then I thought, well, you know what? This Teams technology opened up a whole new world for disabled and chronically ill people. And it is difficult when you've got a chronic illness, the unpredictability of it, of getting out the house, like toilet situation and stuff like that. And this enables me to communicate with the outside world. I think there's a danger though, post-COVID, what I'm calling post-COVID, I'm not sure if it's ended or not, but post-COVID of this emphasis now on, oh, let's get back in the real world type of thing. And now sometimes, like at university things what were suddenly available online during COVID, which was great for me. I thought, great, I don't have to worry about who's going to take me there. My mum or dad at the age of 41, realistically, and all this wheelchair business and all that transport. I don't have to worry about that in the toilet situation. I can do this Teams and Zoom when it's working, and when I know how it works, because that took me ages to figure out. But it did open up this world. And then But then university was like, it was great. And then suddenly now everything's turned into this, oh, let's come back to campus. Let's do it face to face. When I've posed questions like, oh, can we do a hybrid thing, in person and on Teams? Sometimes it's available, some not. It's a bit patchy. And I think we're all learning a new thing, like COVID as well, with the technology. How will technology evolve post-COVID? And but what I will say is technology is fantastic for people with chronic illness in that it does open up a new world. But again, people, you need access to it. That means the cost of having a laptop, a computer, that kind of thing. But also the knowledge, and I'm a bit of a technophobe, I have to say. And sometimes for mature students, it's sometimes assumed you know how to do technology when sometimes the needs are extra sort of support in doing that. Not saying that I've not met loads of mature students who are fantastic at technology, so I'm not saying it's an age thing necessarily, but it was a bit of a learning curve.
I think you're right.
Learning.
Yeah, I mean that was my sense really during lockdown because I actually had this panic really because suddenly, having come into work every day for however many years, decades even, to teach my students, I was suddenly told with immediate effect you have to teach online. And I, even though I had already done this podcast for a couple of years, I couldn't conceptualize how I could do my job with a computer, and I had to make sure I had even things like webcams installed. And then, you know, and until you actually try it out with students, then you're never going to be sure if it'll work. And of course, you want the students to ensure that they have a good experience and that they have access to all the resources you use. And that in some cases, they weren't revealing themselves. They were choosing not to put their cameras on. So I had no way of knowing whether they were completely engaged and enraptured by the whole thing, or whether they were just sort of, you know, doing something else, or distracted, or actually just alienated from the technology. And I suppose that, in a funny way, it's probably all of those at different stages. But what it did do, and I think this is where you're right, it opened up new worlds, because suddenly, just for me, with the podcast, I was able to interview people who were the other side of the world. Forget the fact that, I mean, with COVID, it didn't matter whether you were down the bottom of the street or in another continent. You still couldn't meet up with people for a large part of 2020 or 21. But then suddenly there was this opportunity to sort of think outside of the box. And there aren't many good things that happened, obviously, during COVID. But one of them was that it made us think about how important it was to be with people and to communicate with people. And suddenly it became the new normal. And it went from being a completely alienating and different sort of technology in March 2020. By that summer, as I was saying to you, I think, before we started recording, I remember having internal job interviews when it was all done on Zoom, and we were having to share our screen with colleagues and effectively take questions from other people, and also things like make sure that your backdrops are suitable, or, you know, if you've got a door behind you, that you don't have somebody walking through it while everybody's watching, or you know, you're just sort of aware of those sort of dynamics, which, you know, would have been probably as unusual or difficult to imagine as all those many, many years ago, mobile phones would have been, in an age when we used to have to stand in the street, queue up at 6 o'clock in the evening in order to speak to our families because it was cheaper after 6 o'clock. And we'd be using mobile, phone boxes. Whereas these days, it's quite laughable that you'd actually queue up out in the cold in order to speak to somebody and wait because the five people in front of you want to do the same thing. These days, everyone's got a phone. And if you don't want to speak to the other person, you can just text. But sometimes, you know, technology evolves, and the world of the early 90s and the world of today looks and sounds very different.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think there's a balance, maybe, what's needed, you know, because like you said, you know, some people struggled with the online world, and I know people like who have autism and sensory issues who've found online Teams and Zoom really difficult, people's mental health struggled and that kind of thing, and some people prefer face-to-face and some people prefer online, or a balance, you know. But what I will say, you're right, it did open up a lot of doors, and not just for people with chronic illness, it's helped out, but also like with people and people like you said across the world, communications, but also people with things like, you know, caring responsibilities who have got a lot to juggle, or parenthood who have got kids and with childcare, etc. I've been able to balance that better with, you know, working from home or technology from home, that kind of thing. But yeah, I think a balance. Yeah. But it's amazing how technology has advanced. But I think because I grew up with the world, you know, it can be scary on the other hand as well, because in one way I was lucky I didn't grow up with the internet and mobile phones, you know, didn't have the pressure of the social media trolling out there. I think a lot of young people now are quite under pressure, but it has helped a lot of people as well, and it's technology has become cheaper as well through the years. I mean, I remember when the internet first started, but apparently it first started in the 90s, but I only remember having a computer, I think 2000, it must have been 2001, 2002 time, and I didn't have access to the internet before then, but around them after the millennium it became a bit more accessible.
There was once a time when if you wanted a television set, most people rented theirs. And I remember even in the 90s when I was at university, we'd all, you know, rent a TV in like for 12 months or whatever it was. And sometimes the video, I mean, obviously that's another piece of sort of archaic technology, but the video recorder, the VHS, would often cost more than the television. And so I remember once renting something from Granada or the Co-op or Rumbelows or whatever it was. And then you'd find that, you know, once I think for an insurance thing, maybe I was, you know, had to do some sort of costing, you know, for home insurance, and I had to actually get the cost of the items. And, you know, you'd have like a TV, not a particularly big one, and kind of an ordinary one, a colour TV, sure, 20 inches or whatever, and it was like £600-700. And of course, as a student, I couldn't afford that, and the video was perhaps even more than that. So I was looking at, you know, 1,500. These days, it is a lot cheaper. But if these days your TV breaks, the chances are you'll just get a new one. Whereas in those days, you'd have an engineer who'd come out and repair it. And somehow it was almost like the TV was made to last. If you had a good TV, you'd have it for at least 10 years. Again, it just feels very strange from the point of view of today that we'd have that sort of level of investment in one product. These days, like with phones, people are, we all, myself included, depend on our mobile phones. Yeah. But what we often do, of course, is trade them in after 24 months or whatever it might be and get the next model. And then the other one is either discarded or you return it and maybe you get some money back from that one in order to purchase your new model. And again, that's just very different from the days of actually almost having an engineer on call because your TV remote control isn't working or you can't get BBC Two.
yeah, so true. And talking about renting TVs, on my dad's side, my dad grew up in a very large family, one of nine living children on a council estate called, majority of the time, Saffron Lane Estate in Leicester. I grew up in Beaumont Lees area in Leicester, a different area again, but, you know, known for its, I'd say, people coming, people like survivors and coming through adversity, and that's what I love about Beaumont Leys, the area I grew up in, and it was a very diverse area. And yeah, I didn't have a great school life, and that's a different story, you know. But it made me survive, have that survival instinct. And anyway, in Saffron Lane Estate, where my dad majority grew up, and my mum and dad's parents are very different. They're both working class, but very different working class. And coincidentally, actually, my nana knew Sue Townsend. Sue Townsend is a writer from Leicester who wrote Adrian Mole. And coincidentally, Adrian Mole is coming to the 40th year of the first Adrian Mole series this year. And I take great inspiration from Sue Townsend's work. You know, I think she's so funny and the way she writes. But anyway, and Sue Townsend, she before she became famous, I mean, she stayed living in Leicester after her fame as well. She was very, very loyal to Leicester. And she spent some time living on Ayres Monsell, where my dad lives now. But she also was a youth worker on Saffron Lane Estate, where my nana and my dad lived. And they did great community work back in the 70s. Absolutely fantastic community work. They got things done. None of this like red tape paperwork, you know. And it was mainly women who led it, and then all the families joined up. But they got things sorted for a lot of kids in that area. They rallied round, they'd done fundraisers, like getting auctions and stuff like that, and they took the kids to the seaside on bus trips, and they got an adventure playground for kids, which still exists now in that area. But anyway, my nana had a rented TV, and at the time, apparently you put the coins in at the top of the TV. Well, apparently their house was considered posh because it had lino in the kitchen, and what they'd done was cut around a coin on the lino, cut the lino around and put the lino in the slot, and it worked, and the TV would come on. But they didn't think about the obviously long-term consequences, because it's a very much live in the moment, survive in the moment, you know, think about that later. When the rent man came round for the TV rent man for his money, and also at one point they sold the TV and took all the kids to Skegness for the day, but didn't think about when the TV man would come round for the TV, and apparently they all hid, you know, in the living room, but they never forgot that day trip to Skegness. They never forgot it, you know. And you think, well, was it worth it? Was it worth all the avoiding the TV man? You know, well, all the kids now, grown men with kids and grandkids of their own, still remember it. And it's a story what circulates the family, you know.
I mean, you're right, because it's those sort of things, because they sound so, from the point of view of today, and to anybody, indeed anybody who's listening to this, who was born after those sort of days of having rented TVs and so on, it does feel, and you're absolutely right, it feels like a sort of a different era. And to anybody today, you know, you look at that and just think, what, it's like the past being a foreign land, really, because, you know, I would remember those very physical trips that you'd have to take, you know, to buy things that these days, of course, you can just get online. But actually, I'm very nostalgic for those days, because even now, I mean, if I want to watch a film, I know that sometimes I can just do it from home, but I don't want to do that. And so I'll make the physical trek to the cinema. You know, I mean, cinemas are still going. Maybe that won't happen forever. Who knows? But in a way, it's, and also I didn't really go to the cinema when I was younger, which is odd. It's something that I did. I mean, I did it like university onwards, but it's not something I really did much as a child. So it's almost as though I'm making up, and it's almost as though I'm kind of nostalgic, perhaps, for what I didn't experience. It's like nostalgia for something that you didn't yourself experience, but everybody around you did. So I remember all those conversations in the school playground of people going to see Ghostbusters or the Indiana Jones films, and I only caught up with them in later years. So now whenever I watch those films, all I can remember is what my school friends, some of whom, of course, I'm no longer in contact with, what they were saying, so the enthusiasm, the energy, the excitement that they had. So in those days, I was a bit alienated from it all. And now, of course, I've sort of overcompensated and now, you know, lapped these up. So it's very interesting how sometimes these shifts take place, but we're just not aware of them. They're very subtle.
Yeah. And why didn't you go to the cinema a lot as a kid?
Because I had this obsession, which I suppose I still have, with radio. So for me, going home, the thing that I looked most forward to on weekends or when I was not in school was programmes. In some cases, I'd get my parents to record them for me when I was at school. And I would listen to them and often edit them. So I suppose it's not dissimilar to what I'm doing with this podcast. I'd be getting a programme and I might be taking out most of the music and just sort of having, like, imagine there's a 2-hour programme. I might get 40 minutes or so of just the presenter talking. Or whatever it is, so I'd be, that'd be my little project. So it was just my sort of thing. So people would sometimes say, oh, Chris, do you want to come and watch Back to the Future with us? And I'd be like, oh no, the charts are on or something. So, you know, and looking back, I think, you know, I was missing out on the chance to be with friends. And I got on well with friends, but I suppose looking back, I perhaps did things more in a more isolated sort of way, and I kind of regret that a little bit. So I think I'm making up for it now, but it's interesting. Yeah. but these things sort of happen in their own time. But I have to ask you though, Emma, about the diary, because you mentioned that's in the title of your PhD. Do you want to say a bit more about the project? Obviously that's a good link from what you were saying about Sue Townsend and Adrian Mole. So do you want to say a little bit about the genesis of the PhD and the discipline that you're in and what the PhD is going to ascertain?
Yes. Well, my title changed. Originally my title was How Are Disabilities Represented and Included in the Media? The Significance of Autoethnography Methods? Because that was in twofold, really, because my interest about this inclusion and representation of disabilities in the media, but also of autoethnography method of its own as well. And then it got changed to A Snapshot in Time, an autoethnography exploring consuming life and the media during my PhD pilgrimage from a disability perspective. And when I'd done that last title, I was thinking, What am I doing with that long title like that for? I thought, what am I doing this PhD for? And I realised that I was reflecting on all my education past, which I came back to in my 20s, and I was working full-time at the time as well, and I'm now doing my PhD full-time. But another PhD student within my department, which is Media, Sociology and Communication at the University of Leicester, and I was listening to a podcast he'd done, and he was saying he's had to hack away at everything because he's first or second generation British Asian, and he's had to sort of hack away at everything in the education system and workplace. And I thought, yeah, that's similar to what I've done in a roundabout way, even before my disability and health condition, is sort of hack away. And I did a degree, again, by accident, in a subject which I didn't necessarily want to do at the time. But now I reflect, it is the best thing. It was really the best thing for me. But I've hacked away at these different things along the years. But I've realized, and at least I had the opportunity to hack away and get there, you know, even though it was hard, but I got there. You know, when I'd done my degree, it was in the evenings through Vaughan College, which was run by the University of Leicester at the time, and I was able to do it in the evenings because I realised that Open University wouldn't necessarily suit my learning style at the time. I needed some face-to-face classroom sessions at the time, and I thought, you know, and as well at the time the Arts Council was giving some funding for everyone on that course, which meant it was only £1,000 a year instead of £3,000 a year. So I've had to weigh things like that along the years, but at least, and there was things wrong with in my experience with the essays, what I've done, because I've realised, reflecting back on them, because I'm a bit of a, like you, I'm a bit of a keeper. I like the physical things. So I've kept a lot of my old essays, and I was reading through them last year, and I was thinking, what a load of rubbish these are. What's the purpose of these? These haven't got anywhere out of my cupboard. And I'm thinking, what a load of rubbish. But at least I had that opportunity to hack away and get at it. You know, for young people now, £9,000 a year for an undergraduate. And thank goodness I'm not an international student. That would be three times the amount. I mean, and then you've got all the, you know, the cost of rent, which is quadrupled in percentage wise since my day, you know, and all of that. And I think it's so much difficult for younger people getting into academia, or even mature students as well now getting back into academia. It's much harder because, like in Leicester, for example, unfortunately they got rid of Vaughan College, and then as a mature student, what are your options? You know, even if you can afford it, which a lot of mature students, if they're having to juggle, you know, the house, families, that kind of thing, they don't have a lot of expenditure there, and all the, you know, and there's a lot more hurdles, I think. So at least I had that opportunity. But as I was reflecting last year, what a load of rubbish. I was like reading one. I did have like a published journal article in 2015 or 16 using autoethnography, which was quite, it weren't around much then. It wasn't taught in my education, actually. I found autoethnography by complete accident one day. And I did end up using it in my master's dissertation. But I was a bit like all over the place with it because I didn't know what to do, and I was kind of trying to fit in a box, so I kind of done that wrong, and I've done this journal article about eating disorders using autoethnography. But I was reading it through and I was thinking, this sounds very academic, like I thought. So at the minute I'm kind of rewriting that. And then it kind of led me on to kind of rewriting all my old stuff. Like I'd done one thing, one essay on my undergraduate degree, which, don't get me wrong, it's a fantastic experience. But one of the modules was about contemporary history, and we had to look at, one of the examples we could choose from was modern council house built houses since the World War II, council houses. So I spent like about 2 weeks in the university at midnight because I was working during the day. And I was like, luckily the library was open 24 hours. And I was like, at midnight, reading through all these like old books written by people who never lived off on Saffron Lane in Leicester, which was a predominantly council estate, writing about Saffron Lane, who never lived on Saffron Lane. And I was referencing them in my essay and I was making it all academic. And I'm reading it now thinking, oh my God, I do not want to show this to a person who lives on Saffron Lane, because they'll just like be like, what the hell are you doing? So I'm kind of rewriting that using my family lineage in that now, and a bit about the Sue Townsend bit in it. And I was thinking, well, why don't I just make the title like readable? So I thought, well, with my like influence from Sue Townsend, I thought, well, why not? Just the diary of a disabled PhD student, get the message across, succinct, you know. And it's about these, because as well, I was reflecting on style and layout of thesis, right? And I've read a lot of great thesis, don't get me wrong, a lot of great research, but quite a lot of time I'm reading through and I'm like getting to the juicy bit, you know. So I find myself skimming through and I think that's such a shame. They've spent about 4 6 years doing this research day in, day out, and here I am disrespectfully scanning through it. And I thought, oh, and there's some great thesis out there, but I quite like, and I'm doing a practice based, and coincidentally a friend of mine, Sabrina Smith, she's doing a PhD as well at a different university, and she also teaches creative writing. And that's how I met Sabrina, because she does this creative writing class at Leicester Adult Education College, and I'd done a short course there, this was before lockdown, and met Sabrina, and then she was doing a PhD, and she really influenced me and actually applying to do a PhD, because I thought it was completely wacky me doing a PhD. I absolutely thought it was completely wacker. And, you know, I'm not academic. She influenced me anyway to apply. And here I am doing my PhD. Anyway, I'm doing her class again, coincidentally enough, but a year advanced creative writing class. And she's coming up to the end of her PhD, and she's doing practice-based, but she's doing a fiction novel about 1990s subculture and about race and gender through the 90s, using a lot of music actually. And that's quite interesting, because I was listening to your podcast on Pete, the Broken Greek.
Pete Pafidis.
And that was fantastic. And about how actually songs can remind you of a particular time. And that's so true, can't it? Songs remind you of a particular person or time. You know, diaries don't necessarily have to be in the written format at all. It could be memory, maybe. So I'm quite interested in the creative writing aspect. And I think a lot of actual fiction and memoirs, autobiographies, teach us a lot about sociology and social issues. And I like reading a lot of different types of autobiographies, different layouts. I was reading one lately called by Ben Ashcroft, 51 Moves, and it's about his time growing up in care. And it's a fantastic book, quite different from another one I was reading lately called Takeaway by Angela Huey, about her life growing up in Wales, coincidentally enough, in the top of a takeaway shop, and some racism she incurred through her life and stuff like that. But they're very written very differently, with different styles, and I like that. And I was thinking about the whole layout of a thesis. So mine is more of a challenge on that, I guess, more of a challenge on a traditional layout, and a mixture of a creative writing practice base, but a bit different. So it'll have its introduction, and a bit about autoethnography as well. And then it would be like a novel kind of thing. a diary of a disabled PhD student. And if you think about Sue Townsend, Diary of Adrian Mole, you've got your dates and different examples. And I think it's these little, these daily examples, what you can't, you know, what you have to, it's always like you, and now quite interested in performative and evocative autoethnography, which is kind of showing people, you know, these daily examples of life with chronic illness or disability. There's something about the language used and, you know, and that. So I'm quite interested in exploring that. But also, right, I had this mad idea of doing a website. Right. Now, I'm a complete technophobe. So the website will form part of the PhD. But if it, I think it's going all wrong at the minute. But that's great about autoethnography is you can it's reflect on bad situations as well. What doesn't go right as well as what goes as right. And the mad idea was to do a website and sort of about because. Originally, I thought, well, there could be more disabled people on TV and in literature and stuff like that, right? But actually, I've reflected on the last year, there is a lot of people with chronic illness and disabilities on TV and authors. You don't necessarily see it because a lot of disabilities are hidden. But I was kind of had this idea of making a website where giving like a bio of different disabled people working in the media and an interview with local people working in the media who have a disability as well, but kind of the conversational approach. And then in the website, the diary of a disabled PhD student forming part of that website as a blog kind of thing.
I think that's incredible because what you've done, I mean, what I thought really stood out, Emma, and what you were just saying is that you were looking at sources that were the so-called official sources, the by the so-called authorities, but who were writing about the community, the area where you lived, but in a way that nobody living there could possibly sort of identify with. And there was something quite alienating. And it's interesting that you said that you used the word disrespect. But of course, the disrespect works both ways, because from your point of view, the way that they were writing didn't really fit with the community. You know, who were they writing this for? They were writing about a community, but for what, a particular elite group, a bunch of academics, you know, not writing it for the community who might be living there. And you've just turned that on its head. And then this term, which I use in my own work, and which actually was sort of at the very heart of my nostalgia project, is the turn to the self, a big sort of sociological turn, the subjective turn. And that's where you're not so much looking at all the important, the grand paradigms from all the big theorists, but also you're looking at what, inverted commas, ordinary people are saying, and obviously inverted commas, ordinary people, but the whole sort of, you know, bottom up rather than top down model. And I think also changing, reframing the narrative. And I think that the fact that 30 years ago, that would have been unheard of. And indeed, you know, if you put that proposal forward 30 years ago, no doubt it would have been, you know, looked at through, you know, very, very cautiously and maybe even rebuffed and sort of thought, oh, you know, that's not what a PhD is. You can't do that. I think you're doing something that feels really cutting edge and necessary. And it's interesting that whereas 30 years ago, I'd be very keen to sort of, you know, you overstate sometimes the importance of something, or you want, you know, if you feel that you're contributing to something, if you've got a PhD yourself, there's that sense of being seen as an authority and wanting to promulgate that. I feel very differently now. In many ways, I'm not so much interested in, you know, this notion of the self-appointed important people. It's much more interesting, and that's where the podcast I'm doing, I think, comes in, you know, to have people using their language, to use their own words to frame their discourse rather than have somebody do it for them, because the idea that somehow you're writing for a very narrow constituency, which you undoubtedly are, but that narrow constituency in a way shouldn't just be allowed to, throughout time, just, you know, allowed to persist as if somehow they have a monopoly on what it is that's allowed to be published.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But it's quite interesting, though, because I'm doing a practice-based PhD, and I've been doing that, but part of a like a creative writing practice piece, for example, a PhD, I've read quite a few of them, and I've read my friends as well, peer reviewing it, but you write a sort of 30,000 reflective bit as well, on it at the end. And it's almost expected that that's got to be academic. So you've got this like practice-based PhD, but also, almost like you still got to make it academic. And I'm thinking, well, why do you have to do that then?
Although this is where you may be the person who's breaking the mold in this, because if you get the PhD with this completely new frame as to what a PhD is, then other people will start to use that as a template. So it's interesting that it's almost as though somebody has to be the pioneer, somebody has to start the ball moving in a particular direction. And once that's done, it's like all those like legal cases in America sometimes when it's sort of like, well, because once you have something established in law, or there's something, a particular precedent has been set, then that can always be cited as a reason why somebody else should, you know, should also perhaps go down that kind of pathway. So it sounds actually as though you may have to make various compromises, but it feels that actually what you're doing is something that is very different from how I would have conceived of a PhD when I did mine back in the 90s.
Yeah, and I think that positive way forward, but almost like our answer, the answers to things can be in history as well. This might sound, I'm not religious, right? And I live in Leicester, a very multicultural city, and part of my studies and work, I've been in different religious places in Leicester at various points. I've visited Sikh temples, the Hindu temple, Mormon church I've been in. That's a long story. But I guess my family lineage would be Christian and Catholic. Actually, I didn't find out I was Catholic until much later on, actually. My dad went to a church as a child, and that was a Catholic church, but I never found that out until later on, and they were fantastic in helping the family out and stuff like that. And my nana was from Irish roots originally and stuff, and I knew obviously about the Christian Catholic culture, but never really studied the Bible really. And last year, there was a sequence of events. I call it the year of death, actually. It was first the month of death, and then it became the year of death after, you know, a while, and quite a few people who I know died. And it started off with an old school friend of mine. Her son, he was only 15, and he died of Ewing sarcoma, a rare type of bone cancer. And then you know, a few weeks later, another old school friend of mine, he committed suicide at the age of 40. And then unexpectedly, a friend died of complications from diabetes last December. Another person who I knew for mutually, she had motor neuron disease, and she actually went to, where the country where they do assisted dying.
Switzerland,
anyway,
maybe.
She decided, Yeah, she went there because she was getting frustrated, I believe, in not being able to communicate. And then I was just like, I don't know what it was, but, and then I was kind of reflecting upon like the PhD is like a pilgrimage metaphorically. And then I was reflecting on about these pilgrimage journeys I've done by accident through the years. And I thought, oh, I had a look at the Bible, actually, and a lot of the words, actually, what I was looking at. It's very similar to what's happening now. I mean, you got like Ephesians 6:12, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, it is against the rulers and authorities, against dark powers of this earth. Well, that's like Marxist and Foucault before their time, isn't it? You know, and I think, well, the Bible already done it, didn't they, really? They already said it. And I thought, you know, and then I was looking at the archives of Sue Townsend. The University of Leicester has got some great archives in the University of Leicester, various letters, what people have written to Sue Townsend. And because Sue Townsend had a lot of illness and disabilities later on in her life, and you don't necessarily hear about that side of things. But when she went public about her disabilities, a lot of people wrote to her, like saying, oh, thank you for talking about this. How are you? I've also got, because her diabetes caused problems with her sight and her kidneys, and then she ended up in a wheelchair and had strokes. And she was very frustrated with not being able to see, because obviously she was a writer, she loved to read. And these people were writing to her saying, I've also losing my sight, you know, so good that you've spoke about this, you know, it's really helped me. And there was some, you know, there's, and I've read through all these cards, I've had loads of them, there was like boxes full of people nationally and internationally writing to Sue Townsend. I thought, oh my God, there's something about that, isn't there, you know. And what I was pleased to find, which, but there's only a snippet of it, was there was a magazine from the 1970s, 74, 75, called the Ayres, Monsall and Saffron Lane News. It was like a newspaper thing. And it was a community magazine what went round the Saffron Lane and Ayres, Monsall estate at the time. And it was advertising things, what was going on in the community. Because also what you don't hear about is Sue Townsend's community work, what she'd done, and all the women's community work, what they got done. It was like activism, you know, and I think we can learn about that now because we have too much red tape now. You know, there's eligibility criteria for everything. You've got forms to fill in. And when you're disabled and chronically ill, the amount of admin, what you have to do is incredible. Daphne Hannum Swain, a scholar in Sheffield, she's done a great paper about the added labour of a disabled PhD student, about the extra admin you have to do, basing things up, or disabled people, you know, the amount of extra stuff. But back then in the 70s, that community got things done, and that, there doesn't seem to be much written about that at all. But it's great to find these little magazines from the 70s in the archives. And it said about all the stuff, and they had all sorts. They had and obviously at the time Sue Townsend was a youth worker in that area before she published Adrian Mole, you see, and that's why it was in that archive. Oh yeah, and Sue Townsend coincidentally written When My Nana Died, which I'll try and send you if I figure out how to scan it in properly, but When My Nana Died, the Leicester Mercury brought out a special edition. Newspapers used to be in print a lot, didn't they? Used to be able to buy it quite cheap, but then it all went electric and all that. So Leicester Mercury went all electric, and the Saturday Chronicle was like a Saturday TV guide and all that kind of stuff in it. But it got disbanded and stopped. But they, when my nana died, they brought out a special edition of the Saturday Chronicle and had my nana on the front and a few pages written about her, because through the years she got to know one of the long-term journalists from Leicester Mercury because of all the community work she'd done in the area. Sue Townsend and this journalist written my nana's obituary for this Leicester Mercury piece, which was fantastic. But anyway, but going, that wasn't in the university archives, unfortunately. But I want to publicise it as much as I can, because I think it's fantastic. But in this magazine about the community work in the 70s on the Saffron Lane, you know, there was just loads of stuff going on. It was unbelievable. They had yoga, OAP, bingo, they had parents club, toddlers group where all toddlers can play with each other. They had a writing club, a drama club. They had all these stuff going on. And I thought, wow, where's all that gone then? And I just thought they got things moving, they got things done. Now if you wanted to get something like that up and running, you'd need to have a target audience in mind. Have to write the impact before you've done the impact, and write a grant application and go through all this red tape business, and then have an eligibility criteria for who can come. But they didn't do that in this area in the 70s, and they got things done. And I think that deserves, I think we can learn a lot from that now in modern activism and modern community work in getting things done. So I think our actual stuff is there in history, and yeah, we've developed great as time has gone on with technology and stuff, but the answers are in our history.
And I've got to ask you, Emma, in that sense, could you have imagined a few decades ago that you'd be doing this kind of project? I mean, could you ever have imagined? We were talking earlier about how it's not always possible to imagine what the future will look like, for example, in terms of technology. But you're obviously on a roll with all of this at the moment, and you're very much renegotiating the way, you know, paradigms of the past were set, and you're doing things in a different sort of way. But does this sort of, do you sometimes reflect on how maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, you just could never have anticipated that you'd be undertaking this kind of work and seizing control of the narrative?
Oh, no. Like everything, it seems to be a complete accident, but somehow very meaningful. And I've still not figured it all out yet. Mm. And I think we have to take these twists and turns through our life, you know, and the journey, some journeys not easy, yeah, but, and I think them twists and turns make for you as a, you building as a person and building in your strength and character. And if I finish, and I do want to finish on time, and the reason I want to finish on time, people say, oh, you shouldn't have an end date for your PhD. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Well, yeah, try telling that to a disabled person. Metaphorically, we can't do a marathon and sprint unless we're a Paralympic or something like that. But, you know, we have to plan in advance for every eventuality, right? But another reason why I want to finish on time, in summer 2024 will mark my 20th anniversary of being in higher education. I started in 2004, in my 20s, and I started doing a higher education certificate in the evenings. Then I started doing a degree in the evenings, and luckily that was only 3 years. And I've had breaks in between as well for a few years. And then I'd done my master's in social work for 2 years, had a break, then I come back. But neither at any of them stage, I thought, oh, I'm going to go on to the next stage in academia. My dream was to do a degree. That was my ultimate dream. As a kid, I always dreamt about doing a degree. First one in my family. First one in my immediate family, definitely. In my wider family, I mean, bearing in mind my dad's one of nine, I do have a couple of cousins who have a degree, and I have a cousin's child who now has a degree and master's, but very, like, few and far between. And that was my dream, and it was, in my day, it was sort of maybe achievable, because if I'd have been sensible and done it chronologically on time, I'd have just got in where university was actually free, and you could get a grant as well. But I weren't sensible, unfortunately. Yeah. Well, I didn't do it that way.
Well, you see, that's hindsight, isn't it? But I've got, and actually my last question actually is on that very topic, about whether you're, Emma, a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, that's a chicken and egg question, that is, I think. Which comes first, the chicken or egg? I ain't got the foggiest. I think it's a bit of both. I think, looking back is definitely good. Yeah. But do you think sometimes when you look back, sometimes you think, like, maybe the grass was green on the other side, like, you think of things through that everything was perfect when you look back, when actual fact it wasn't, when you think more deeply. And, you know, when people say school years were the best years of my life, and almost like we've become conditioned to say that, and actually no, they're not necessarily the best years of your life, but they're learning curves, you know. And sometimes you can put them bad experiences to good use as well, but I don't necessarily, I do think of the future in some respects as in getting through certain hurdles and situations and stuff like that. And like, I want to finish my PhD on time. That is my goal in my head. And them kind of things. But I never thought I'd be sitting here doing a PhD 20 years ago. I never even thought I'd be sitting here 5 years ago. And I think, oh, sometimes there's things like with brushes with death as well, what make you think differently. And through my chronic illnesses, when I've had a number of long hospital stays, my last one, coincident, I was supposed to start my PhD in 2020, but I ended up in hospital for 2 months, not because of COVID, because of a complication of my condition, and I ended up getting quite ill, but they didn't realize that. Anyway, it's a long story, but it kind of made you reflect a bit like differently, like, well, why are you doing this kind of thing? Life's short, you know, what do you actually want to do? And about other people who have died who I've known, you know, what would they think reading this? You know, would they like it? That's almost in my head. If I went anywhere to my family, if I went to my parents to read it, would they like it? You know, that's what I'm thinking now. That's the importance in my head. Not for an elite academic who I don't know over there, you know, although that's important, don't get me wrong. But you know, so I think my audience has kind of changed a bit in my head, but I've always been interested in the narrative and people getting through adversity and struggles and that kind of thing, whatever that might be. It might be something else, not just disability and chronic illness, but different things. But I think last year I learned a lot about explore. That's a good thing about a practice PhD, is that, you know, part of it is exploring, not having set research questions as such, although they have developed, you know, but exploring where the possibilities can take you, not having a narrow kind of vision. Because with disability and health, it is these little wider things what affect this narrow thing, you know, and about taking it all into consideration. And I like speaking to different people from different backgrounds, different disciplines, and I think that's important because it gives you different perspectives.
Well, Emma, what you're saying is so inspiring. And I think that anybody listening to this who might also feel as you were some years ago, that maybe a PhD didn't seem as presently configured or as previously configured, doesn't quite suit them. I think that you're redrawing the narrative. And I can't wait to see how this all unfolds over the next few years. But Emma, what a real treat to catch up with you. Thank you so much for being my guest.
No, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.